All right, well, who remembers what book of the Bible we are studying?
First Enoch.
First Enoch. Somewhat. All right, well, who followed their orders from last week that there would be no reading or thinking about verse 6, that there would be no research on it or attempts to figure it out, and definitely no talking to Denny about it? How many fulfilled all this? Okay. All right, good. All right, well, Maxwell Coder's commentary on Jude is called The Acts of the Apostates. And as you remember, I bought that book just because of the title. I thought that was a great title. He offers these words about Jude in his introduction. Jude brings the teaching of the entire Bible about apostasy to a tremendous climax. He takes us back to the very dawn of human history. We are reminded of apostasy at the gate of Eden and within God's ancient people, Israel. Our thoughts are turned to princes and prophets, to saints and sinners, to eternal fire and everlasting darkness, to the sea and to the stars, to past judgments and future glory. We are taken into the unseen world for a strange and terrible story of the sin of fallen angels and another story of a dispute between Michael the archangel and Satan, those antagonists who are set over against each other once more in the mortal combat in Revelation 12. And then a couple paragraphs later, he asks, why should such a rich storehouse of Bible truth have been so seriously neglected? All right, well, today we are going to dive into that, into some of that unseen world of the strange and terrible story of fallen angels. You may remember in the introduction at our first week, a while back now, my apprehensions about several challenges that we would be facing in this short book. One of the more weighty ones is Jude's use of ancient apocalyptic literature. He draws from two apocryphal books, the Book of Enoch and the Testament of Moses. And this, of course, has the potential of causing all sorts of problems. And so we need to make sure that we have a good understanding of what is going on with all that. And I addressed all that in part three, and if you missed it, you'll want to go to the website and get caught up, because that issue will keep coming up. It comes up a little bit today. It'll come up quite a bit next week and then the week after that as well. A second weighty challenge is found here in verse 6. What is the sin that the angels have committed that we'll be looking at? And there are some interesting theories about all that, and that will be our subject for today. Another challenge that will fall in our laps will come next week, and that is the story in verses 9 and 10 about Michael, the archangel, arguing with the devil over the body of Moses. And with that, Jude issues a condemnation for those who slander or blaspheme celestial beings. And so, you know, what's all this about? And the other troublesome passage comes toward the end of the letter in verse 23, as Jude wraps up his final words of exhortation and instruction. He leaves his readers with this final charge to hate even the garment stained by the flesh. And that's a rather odd statement, and it's one that's not easy to make a lot of sense of. So in essence, even though this is a short letter, there's certainly no shortage of challenges here in it, which explains why it is usually neglected. Now today, again, we're going to tackle verse 6 in particular. So let me give you the heads up here. We have a lot of material to cover. Some of it will be a little technical. You'll need to make the extra effort this morning to stay with it and follow along. If you fall asleep, I will call you out by name. I have a lot of slides to help keep us on track. That's really the purpose, to help you see what we're talking about at the moment. If it is your custom to take notes, you may find it a little hard to do that today, and I would maybe just encourage you to sit back instead, download the slides from the website, which will be posted by Wednesday. And while we're at it, keep in mind that the messages in this series are not intended to be standalones. Rather, they all fit together as a unit. Every week builds on something that was discussed previously. And so if you have missed or will miss any of these sermons, be sure to visit the website and get caught up. The actual verse-by-verse study of Jude will consist of only 8 weeks, 8 parts. It should end here on Mother's Day of next month. That's the plan. So it should be rather manageable to fill in whatever you might miss in this short series. Okay, so for some of you who miss often, get caught up. All right. Let's just go on. I was going to make fun of some people, but I could upset them. Who knows? All right, so what about verse 6? As with any passage of Scripture, especially difficult ones, we must start, of course, with the context itself, attempting to follow the author's train of thought at least the best we can. And verse 6 is part of a smaller unit consisting of verses 5 through 8. And as you will remember, this unit is the first of five such units in which Jude condemns these false teachers who had wormed their way into this particular church body. And you'll see the structure of that there on your ivory handout. So let's begin by reviewing what we covered last week in regards to Jude's point in verses 5 through 8. And this then will set things up for today's discussion. So we'll read the text here, starting with verse 5. I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. Verse 6, and the angels, who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. Yet in like manner, these people also, relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones. All right, in this first denunciation of the intruders, Jude recalls three examples in the past, examples of gross disobedience. And then he compares that disobedience to these false teachers. The first one deals with those who were graciously and miraculously delivered from their Egyptian oppressors. However, there were those among them who didn't trust God, cried out to return to Egypt, complained about God's deliverance, and complained about his plan for them, rejected it, and were therefore destroyed. The second example deals with angels who rejected the sphere of dominion that God had ordained for them. Like the Israelites, they had enjoyed God's favor, but chose instead to pursue their own course. The third example Jude draws upon involves the sexual immorality of Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, we have something established in God's perfect order, something he has ordained for his holy purposes, which is then flatly refused. In this case, natural sexual relations are openly rejected for grossly unnatural ones, and the punishment no less severe. All three examples underscore not only a tragic loss, but also an enduring permanent loss. They all share in common a radical act of disobedience and apostasy, and all, therefore, were radically expelled from the privilege of God's favor and blessing and experience the execution of his swift and sure judgment. And it should be quite clear here that God is resolved to oppose all that opposes his divine order. Now, it is worth noting here at the start that when it comes down to it, it doesn't really matter whether we can identify the exact nature of the sin the angels committed or not. We're going to have to keep that in mind. Judas told us enough to make the point he wanted us to get. They rebelled and they were punished. If elaborating on the specifics of that rebellion was essential to making his point, then he would have done so. The reason we are spending time on it today is because I thought it would be fun to drag us all down into an endless discussion of myths and genealogies that promote controversies, to borrow a line from 1 Timothy. Right? How many know that line from 1 Timothy? All right. Based on only a couple giggles, I thought maybe nobody knew it. All right. Actually, to be serious, the passage is the subject of some debate, verse 6 here, and it would serve us well to be familiar with the issues involved and different positions that have been taken. And as you can see, verse 6 is rather interesting, fascinating, and it would be rather cheap to just sidestep it. And since our study of Jude is verse by verse, then like all the other verses, I think with this one too, we should take whatever effort is necessary to understand it the best we can. But again, just to underscore this, when it is all said and done, the thing that we need to leave here this morning with is this. The main issue is the fact that the angels disobeyed God, not exactly the specifics of that disobedience. All right, so let's start with the problem. First, Jude doesn't, in verse 6, elaborate on the sin the angels have committed. As already stated, he simply says that they did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling. He offers nothing specific beyond that, which means, of course, any speculation about that, about what that might mean, has to be held with a light grip. Secondly, we don't find anything in the Old Testament that uses the same kind of language in describing this particular offense. And so again, we have nothing here where we can say, at least with any absolute, at least with any certainty, oh look, Jude is talking about this. There are speculations about a passage in Genesis 6, which we will get to, but these statements did not stay within their own position of authority and left their proper dwelling and are now kept in eternal chains and gloomy darkness. We don't find anything like those statements in the Old Testament, especially in regards to angels. Thirdly, part of the problem here, and this is where gasoline is poured on the fire, verse 7 could be making a contribution to the identification of the sin. And the key word here, of course, is could. In fact, since verse 7 plays such a major role in this whole discussion and is to a large degree at the center of the debate, we want to go ahead at this time and take a look at it. And we'll consider it from both the English Standard Version and the New International Version. These two versions treat verse 7 a bit differently, and they, at least in this case, would represent the differences we would find in all the other English translations as well. So starting with the ESV, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example of undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. The words, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, do they refer to the angels in the previous verse? If so, then the angel's sin would involve sexual immorality, that is, of pursuing something God has forbidden, something unnatural. This is one way to read that passage, and from what I have looked into, there is nothing in the Greek that would prevent that rendering or that understanding. However, is it not possible that the statement underlined here on the screen could instead be referring to those cities surrounding Sodom and Gomorrah? If so, then the passage is simply stating that the whole region reeked with the sin of homosexuality, and that this sin is yet another example of open rebellion against God. Okay, follow so far? Just shake your head yes, even if you didn't follow. All right, going to the NIV. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. Well, this translation doesn't connect it to the surrounding cities at all. And while it could refer to angels sinning sexually, such a suggestion in this translation is actually pretty weak. Rather, it favors the idea that the previous two examples, Israelites and angels, shared with Sodom and Gomorrah a common apostasy and therefore shared in a common judgment. And therefore, together, all three situations serve as sobering examples for us to seriously reflect upon. So we basically have three possibilities here. Jude could be saying, just as the angels pursued unnatural sexual relations, so did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Or, just as Sodom and Gomorrah pursued unnatural sexual relations, so did their nearby cities. If so, then verse 7 wouldn't be making any comment at all about the sin of the angels in the preceding verse. And the third possibility, just as the Israelites and angels disobeyed God by rejecting his divine order, so did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. If so, then again, there would be nothing in verse 7 that would contribute to our understanding of what the angels actually did. So, to boil it down, verse 7 itself leaves us with either door number 1 or door number 2. It is identifying the sin of the angels, and that sin involves a sexual perversion. Or, Judah has moved on, and there's nothing in his sentence here that has anything to do with the angels. All right, maybe at this time we should take a vote. Door number 1 is actually quite popular, so we need to spend some time on it. If the angel's sin is sexual in nature, then our understanding of verse 6 would go something like this. Forsaking their positions of authority and proper dwelling would be referring to a certain number of angels who left heaven, came to earth, took on human form perhaps, or however that worked, and united themselves sexually with human women. And here are some of the main arguments to support this view. It seems unlikely that Jude would use an example that his readers would not be familiar with. And this account of angels leaving heaven to unite with human women was quite popular in Jewish tradition and Jewish literature at the time Jude wrote this letter. References to this could actually be found in numerous apocryphal books. And so the original readers, when they came to verse 6 and 7, would have made the immediate connection. Ah, that's what Jude is talking about. One such apocryphal book that devotes a great deal of attention to this particular subject is the book of Enoch. And we know from verses 14 and 15 that Jude is familiar with that book and is willing to draw from it. And it would seem likely, therefore, that Jude is also borrowing from it here in verse 6. In fact, these key expressions here in verse 6 are found in the book of Enoch. Enoch, chapter 12, verse 4. Abandon the high heaven, the holy eternal place. Verse 28 of chapter 68, they shall be bound with chains and imprisoned in their place of assembly. And verse 8 of chapter 103, and into darkness and chains and a burning flame where there is harsh judgment. The book of Enoch, as I shared with you weeks ago, tells the whole story of how 200 angels left heaven. They're called watchmen. They married human women. They brought evil and destruction into the world. They taught humans all sorts of detestable and wicked practices like witchcraft and sorcery and astrology, for instance, and how to perfect warfare using weapons of metal, swords, and so forth, and even introduced a whole art of cosmetics, from war paint to even women wearing makeup. And it goes on to explain that these marriages produced a race of giants, offspring, who were half angel and half human, that their souls, upon their deaths, became the demons and evil spirits that have and continue to possess victims through the centuries. So, an argument here is that there is a connection. A third part of this, a third supporting point, another major point to this position is that the Bible itself, it is claimed, gives an account of this very thing back in Genesis 6. And chances are, this is a passage you have read before and have probably wondered about or have been involved in some discussions on. All right, so let's take a look at it. Genesis 6, when men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married any of them that they chose. How many are familiar with this? Somewhat? Okay, just about everybody. The Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Those are the main verses, and then it continues to elaborate on this a little bit. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, that his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe out mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. All right. According to this position, the sons of God in verse 2 are a reference to angelic beings. And we would find examples of that in both the Psalms and the book of Job. So that's not a stretch to make that connection. The Nephilim, these men of renown, would be the offspring of these perverted unions, giants. And the reason for the great flood, which then follows in the rest of the chapter, is because of the infiltration of these false angels. Mankind has become polluted both morally and biologically. God needed to wipe them all out and start over. And, of course, another supporting point for this position is the rendering of verse 7 of Jude. If you read it a certain way, out of certain translations, it could seem to be saying that Sodom and Gomorrah and the angels, that they all of them together are being compared as pursuing unnatural, sinful sexual relationships. All right, so what are we to make of this? Could there be anything to it? Could it be true? Well, it's certainly not unreasonable for Jude to refer to something his readers would be able to recognize, even something from the popular literature of his day. It is also not unreasonable to suggest that verse 6 has been influenced by the book of Enoch. It is also not unreasonable to think that Jude had Genesis 6 in mind, and that he subscribed to this particular understanding about that passage, which I just laid out. It's also not unreasonable to suggest that in verse 7, Jude is comparing the unnatural lust of Sodom and Gomorrah to that of fallen angels. In fact, this whole position here, though a bit bizarre, is held to by many of the scholars and commentators that I've been relying on for my research on this epistle. And these are actually top guys who are widely recognized as being responsible teachers of Scripture. Douglas Moo, Richard Bauckham, Thomas Schreiner, Peter Davids, Gene Green, Edward Blum, and many more. And so one would want to be a little reluctant to square off with them and challenge their conclusions. But there does appear to be some holes, or at least some soft spots, to this position. Saying that something is not unreasonable is not the same as saying it is true. It would be unreasonable, for instance, to suggest that given my hatred for housework, and given that serving others is not my spiritual gift, that I didn't do any cleaning or cooking or laundry or dishes during this time Terry has been confined to the chair. But if you came to our home, you'd have to conclude that your assumptions, which all the experts would make as well, are left wanting. Those assumptions are left wanting. All right, so first of all, we have too much being built on too many assumptions here. And this cannot be overstated. Jude may not have even had the book of Enoch in mind here in verse 6. He makes no comment about it one way or the other, so we don't know. This language about abandoning the high heaven and being bound with eternal chains and held in prison for the great judgment, that language is not unique to Enoch. They were common expressions in apocalyptic literature of that day, and they were common expressions used by Christians all the time. There is nothing in Jude that requires us to conclude that he was influenced by the book of Enoch when he wrote verses 6 or 7. We are also assuming, We are also assuming that Jude has in mind the passage in Genesis 6. But again, Jude doesn't tell us that. It may be the case, but we can't really say with any certainty. And we don't really have any clues about what Jude thought about Genesis 6. The passage, again, doesn't say. In fact, he may not have believed that the sons of God mentioned there were angels at all. There are at least two other viable interpretations of that passage, which we will look at here shortly. We are also assuming in verse 6, we're also assuming that verse 6 is something the readers themselves would quickly pick up on and easily identify. We assume that, but we don't know that for sure. Instead of thinking of angels uniting sexually with women, they may have actually pictured angels from before the creation of the world, rejecting God's ordained plan for them, rebelling against God, exchanging their proper place of serving God in glory to serving Lucifer instead. We know that there was some sort of fall at that point. In fact, they may have just taken the whole verse on face value and tried not to read too much into it all. That too is a possibility. Along with these assumptions is the questionable interpretation of Genesis 6 itself. Now, we don't have time this morning to exegete those seven verses, but there are some things here that we do need to kind of consider. The passage indicates that the sons of God married the daughters of men. If there was sexual sin, then we would expect something other than the word married to describe it. Along this line, Jesus pointed out that angels don't marry. They don't reproduce. And so how did all that actually work? Did the angels procreate without the use of natural bodies? Or did they create for themselves natural bodies by the use of some mysterious, intrinsic, but rebellious power? And it would be a bit odd to refer to fallen angels who rebel against God as sons of God. And the Nephilim, these giants, may have simply possessed genetic information for great height and strength that is no longer in our gene pool. We should not automatically assume that the only possibility is a supernatural parentage. In fact, the Nephilim reappear later in the Old Testament, long after the flood. In Numbers 13, are we to conclude that another set of angels left heaven and united with women in the same way again? Maybe some of them survived the flood. I don't know. And why would the human race be wiped out because of the sin committed by angels? If this account in Genesis 6 is about angels forsaking their God-ordained domain in heaven and committing sexual sin with human women, then we would expect something to be said about their judgment. Instead, the judgment in Genesis 6 is all on the humans. We would also have to wonder about the angels' motivation for all this. This isn't something I picked up anywhere, but I got thinking about it, and I kind of wondered about it. The passage is quite clear about what drove these sons of God to marry the daughters of men. It was because the daughters of men were, what were they? They were beautiful. That was the attraction. It's difficult to imagine that a whole horde of spirit beings who have no sexual functions or desires would experience this physical attraction toward the physical beauty of a human woman, so much so that they would forsake their celestial glory just so that they could marry them. I just find it a little bit hard to swallow. Well, on and on we could go. The fact is, going back to holes and soft spots, there are two other interpretations of Genesis 6 that have a lot going for them and should always be a part of the discussion when these sorts of things come up. So let's just take a quick look at them. And emphasis here is quick. We can't really flesh them out a lot, but just to introduce you to them. One popular school of thought claims that the sons of God refer to those who were descendants of Seth. They were part of the covenant people. And according to Genesis 4, they called themselves by the name of the Lord. That is, the sons of God. They were forbidden to intermarry with the descendants of Cain, defined here as the daughters of men. This view is called the Sethite view. It is not without its problems either, but it certainly fits into the context of Genesis much, much better. The preceding chapters, 4 and 5, focus on the lineage of Seth and Cain, and so the beginning of chapter 6 just naturally fits into all that quite well, and it doesn't require us to import all sorts of foreign ideas into the passage. Another position is that the sons of God refer to kings, nobles, and members of royalty. In ancient literature, we know that such rulers were referred to as sons of God or sons of a deity. These kings lusted for power, and to increase their power, they would take wives from among the common people, forcing them to join their harems, and so polygamy was a big problem, big issue in all this as well. And the offspring of these kings and nobles could easily become the men of renown, as it says here. In fact, in Genesis 10, Nimrod, a famous early king, is identified by this same Hebrew word. This position, what is called the royalty view, is not without its weaknesses either. But like the Sethite view, it too fits squarely within the historical context of that time. Another thing that seems rather odd is the inconsistency we would be left with in regards to the three examples Jude uses to press his point. If the angels sinned sexually, and they had this in common with Sodom and Gomorrah, who also sinned sexually, then why didn't Jude use an instance of sexual sin for his first example? Certainly there would have been plenty to choose from in the Old Testament. And given the organization we find in Jude's letter, even in the organization of his themes, this would leave us a bit puzzled. It would seem that Jude would either list three examples of an identical sin, or three examples where the sins were different, but they all nonetheless represented apostasy or radical disobedience. And when it comes to verse 7, as we saw earlier, it can be understood in two or three different ways, and it would be a bit irresponsible to actually rely on it for support for either position. All right, so where does this leave us? I would say that among these holes and soft spots here, that there's probably nothing here that's actually a deal breaker. There's probably ways to explain how they could still work. From what I can tell, there doesn't really appear to be anything in Jude or Genesis or anywhere in the Bible that would actually forbid one from subscribing to this theory that the angels' sin was sexual. But at the same time, there isn't anything that requires it. There are too many unsettled issues here that would prevent us from making any hard conclusion one way or the other. If, for whatever reason, you favor that position, then I would say, well, you could be right. Who knows? But I would also say given that this is not an essential doctrine of the faith, and given that Christians through the centuries have held to various positions on this, and given that the theory is based on a lot of assumptions and certainly has its share of problems, you should not get dogmatic about it. You need to be open to the possibility that you could be wrong. And the same could be said to those who believe the opposite, that Jude 6 has nothing to do with angels marrying women, nor the sixth chapter of Genesis. If that is your position, hold it with a light grip. How can you say one way or the other with absolute certainty? Up until about a year ago, when I started looking more into this passage here in Jude, I would have said, in regards to the angels sinned sexually theory, absolutely not. No way. That's crazy. I'm still not inclined to buy into it, but I would be a bit softer in my resistance to it than I was a year ago. There are certain things about the position that I find hard to swallow, but in the end, I am content to say, I don't know. I don't know. So let me summarize the issue at hand with these 4 points, and these are the things I want to make sure that you leave with today. First, again, Jude doesn't define the sin of the angels in verse 6. It could be a reference to a sexual sin, or it could simply be referring to their original fall, a time in the ancient past where they abandoned their place of service in order to follow Lucifer and his agenda. Or maybe something else. Again, the text itself doesn't say, and we have to be content to leave it at that. Verse 7, of course, is inconclusive. It could be understood in a number of different ways and is therefore limited in providing any significant input on this question one way or the other. Thirdly, Genesis 6, of course, is a difficult passage to understand. It is obscure, and there isn't now nor never has been a general consensus on how to interpret it. There are 3 viable interpretations, each with their own strengths and weaknesses. And given the unsettledness of how to understand it, it is best not to anchor any doctrinal argument on it one way or the other. And 4, in the end, as stated before, the point Jude makes stands regardless of what the angels actually did. They left their place of authority. They rejected their domain of service. They chose another course rather than the one God had for them, and in so doing, they rejected God. In this way, they shared with the Israelites and Sodom and Gomorrah, along with the false teachers Jude warns about, a common act of apostasy, and will therefore share a common judgment. And it is not essential that we define the sin in verse 6 more than this. So in the end, all I can say about verse 6 with full assurance and unwavering confidence is this. There are things about it we know. There are some things here that we think we know. And there are things here that we simply don't know. And that's probably the best note to end this particular message on. So what I would like to know from you, who here plans to live radically different this week because of today's life-changing sermon? Anybody? People are always wanting something practical and relevant. I thought this might be one of those, but apparently not. All right, next week we will jump from the frying pan into the fire. We have in verses 9 and 10 the second condemnation of the false teachers. The story here of Michael, the archangel, arguing with the devil, and they're arguing about the body of Moses, and what in the world is all this about? And in that, Jude warns about slandering or blaspheming celestial beings. Okay, I promise not to do that. I'll never blaspheme another celestial being. How many have ever blasphemed a celestial being? You know, who would want to anyway? So what's really going on here anyway? And addressing all that next week, I will not be as middle of the road as I have been today. I'll be back to my resolved, highly opinionated, I am right about this normal self. So that's what you have to look forward to. I also hope to tackle the third condemnation found in verses 11 to 13. And there we find the most colorful language in the whole letter. The intruders are called hidden reefs, waterless clouds, twice dead trees, wild waves of the sea, wandering stars, and so on. So we've got lots of fun stuff there. So if things go as planned, we'll be covering quite a bit next Sunday. And just to give you a heads up, you may want to bring your lunch. All right. Unlike last week, I will encourage you this week to go ahead and read ahead. Do any of the research you want to. Feel free to figure things out on your own. But I still forbid you to talk to Denny about anything in the book of Jude. All right. Let's bring the children in. The musicians could come forward, and as they do, this Psalm 100, very familiar. perhaps will allow us to focus our thoughts on giving thanks to God and praise to Him. Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before Him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is He who made us, and we are His. We are His people, the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him and praise His name. For the Lord is good, and His love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations.